penetrating and perfect dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Adding it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning. And I get to take this off because I'm talking, but could somebody turn the mic a little bit? It's that blinking blue light is very distracting. No, just turn it so that it's not, you turn it all the way around so it isn't blinking anybody. So nothing special. That's we nobody had talked about control in that first section. And nobody talked about nothing special, though it did come up on skip night as well. So I don't know if you read Nothing Special, it occurs to me that you may not have. He says, our purpose is just to keep this practice forever. Strictly speaking, for a human being, there is no other practice than this practice. There is no other way of life than this way of life. Zen practice is the true, direct expression of our true nature. And I kind of struggled with that. You know, it sounds so arrogant and what's the word I want? Exclusionary or something like that. For a human being, there's no other practice. And I've come to an understanding of it. I don't know exactly what he meant. I don't think that he meant it in an arrogant way. I think he meant it in a way that comes back to nothing special. The epigraph is, you know, I actually looked it up because I said it last week and I thought, oh, I'm not absolutely positive. It turned out I was right. You know, when there's a little quote to begin a chapter or whatever, and these quotes here are taken from the text itself. But it says, if you continue this simple practice every day, you will obtain some wonderful power. Before you attain it, it is something wonderful. But after you attain it, it is nothing special. All those attaining words for me. You have to say something. And what I've come to, and I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say, is that this nothing special is the superpower. You know, in the wonderful book, A Tale for the Time Being, part half about the author and half about a young girl in Japan. And the young girl has a grandmother, I think she is, who is a Zen abbess in a tiny temple, I think, up north and up in the mountains above Fukushima. And she teaches, her granddaughter's having a really hard time in school. So she teaches her granddaughter a superpower, and their superpower turns out to be Zazen. And it is ironic that after you've been practicing for at least a substantial length of time, more than a year, say, you begin to get a feel for this practice. And you begin to see how much your ego gets in your way. And Zach, I don't think she'll come in. I'm not sure. I'm going to ask you, I don't know if it's easy to find, but you know in the bookshelf where the telephone is and that stuff?
Yeah.
I think on the shelf that has some things on it, like bookmarks and I don't know what all, there is one of those little things to hold open a book. It's dark. Yeah, heavy. It's either dark blue or black or dark colored. So you begin to find what he refers to in the excerpt we read, the secret of Zen practice. And your grip starts to lose, your grip on your ego and yourself and your I'm this and I'm that and I want me mine, it starts to loosen, you know, and I think it happens regardless of whether you have a big kensho or not. It just happens, you know, if you regularly sit and pay attention, and you start to notice how you get in your own way. And even Kate talks about starting out and thinking she was going to get enlightened. I don't know if you had a timeline, but it was relatively short, I think. And she was going to get enlightened, and then all of her problems would drop away, and everything would be great, and she would be, I don't know if you said it quite like this, but she's like, she would be perfect then. No problemo. Oh, well. Oh, well. And what you see over and over again is just how imperfect you are and how you resist anything that is difficult or scary, or how you make things worse for yourself and for other people. Okay, I take it back. The dog keeps coming in the room. If you're listening to this tape, the dog is, I thought she wouldn't, but she did. And it just pulls the door shut. And now she's coming around to the other side, but she's more habituated to not coming in on that side. We'll see. At any rate, the more you practice, the more you see. And the more you get to know, and then the more you have maybe little experiences, maybe sometimes a big experience, but you have these experiences of letting go and of seeing a fruit of practice. Not that you were trying to attain it or anything, it just happens. And maybe after the fact, you notice, oh, X happened and I was not so reactive this time. So that's the kind of thing that I think that he's talking about. When it happens, when that kind of thing happens, it's completely nothing special. That's the whole point, that it's nothing special. When you don't even necessarily notice it as it's happening, it's just afterwards, you say, oh, wowee. And it's pretty wonderful. But at the same time, it's nothing special. That's the whole thing, is that what's so special is that you become less special. There's less of a need for recognition, less of a need for self-protection. Go on, get back. No, stretching's not gonna help you. Hi, can you get just close the door? I don't know why she's particularly needy today. She'll just go upstairs and go back to bed. But why in the sun you can't?
I think the door in there to the stairs. I think the door to the stairs is closed.
Well, she does, but if the door in the hallway is closed. This is a lecture about a dog.
Could be worse thing.
She wants to be something special. She is something special. But what's one of the, her great superpowers is that she doesn't hold on to it. You know, if you close the door here, she doesn't sit there and whine and moan and jump at the door. She used to, but she doesn't. And she'll just go do something else. As I say, she'll go upstairs and go to bed on her favorite bed. Or she'll go outside and lie in the sun if it's a sunny day. So on. So at any rate, the superpower is nothing special. And that frees you to express your true nature. And one of the things he talks about, you know, as long as you think, I am doing this, I have to do that, or I must attain something, and I'm going to add, or I can't do that, or I hate this, then he says you're not doing anything. Because I mean, in some sense, what you're doing then is getting in the way of the flow of the Dharma. The ego is getting in the way. It got inflated to a huge beach ball instead of a little cantaloupe. So he says that Zen practice is the direct expression of our true nature. And it doesn't mean that you should get stuck in emptiness, that our true nature is only the emptiness side, the absolute side. No. It's both and. It's both and. Our true nature is also just being who we are, including the flaws. Just as, I don't want to say this, but just letting go of this I, me, mine is nothing special. Being willing to see our flaws and wholeheartedly work with them, but not get caught by them. Not think you're so special with your problems. You know, with it. I know I've told you this before. Years ago, I was probably only been practicing a couple of years, I don't know, something like that, two or three. Anyway, but before that, I used to think that I was really special because I had big family problems. My mother was demented and had arthritis, serious arthritis. And my mother was an alcoholic. And my father had multiple sclerosis of a kind that was progressive, and he was in a wheelchair and couldn't really get around. It was hard for him to get around and so on. So unless you had serious chronic illness in your family and alcoholism in your family, don't even talk to me about troubles. You don't know from troubles.
That's a song.
Yeah, and I used to think I couldn't say all of that at the same time because I would upset somebody too much if I said it all. So I'd sort of, you know, I'd say my dad has MS, say, or my mother is an alcoholic, or my mother has cancer, or whatever. And those are all true. I mean, she did have cancer. But at any rate, I wouldn't say it all together because I thought it was overwhelming for people. And sometimes maybe it was. And there are times when you say those, share that sort of thing, and times when you don't. But at any rate, I thought it was too much. And inwardly, you know, if I said something and somebody said, my mother sprained her ankle, I would inwardly think, jerk. It was worse than, more than jerk. But it wasn't even necessarily a word. And I would just inwardly tense up and hate them. They didn't know from troubles. And one day, I was leaving Berkeley Zen Center, and Ross was outside for whatever reason. He's one of the senior people there. And I don't know how it even came up, you know, but I said something about my parents or my dad, or I don't know, something about these troubles, you know. And Ross's response was, yeah, you know, every family has its mishigas. And I said, yeah, it's true. And then I kept walking. I was walking up the block to my car. And I was about halfway up the block, and I thought, wow, I did not resent that. Because you know, it was arguably a little dismissive. But in the past, I would have been furious, just furious, and really hurt and resentful. And I just wasn't. Because every family does have its mishigas. Does everybody know the word mishigas? It's a Yiddish word. It means like a stew of troubles or craziness. So that was for me a fruit of practice. Oh, I'm not so reactive about that anymore. I don't feel that I'm so special. My family is really a mess. Your family. So that's a superpower. You know, that's a wonderful fruit of practice. And as I say, I didn't notice it at the time. I walked half a block before I thought, oh, hey. And which was all, that was extra. But that's okay. I think it's all right to take pleasure in it. To be proud of it is a problem. And when he says, strictly speaking, for a human being, there is no other practice. I think he means that in order to be fully human, you need to, our effort is, I'm trying to not use a gaining idea word, but I'm not sure I could succeed, but in order to be fully human, you need to fully let go of all the specialness. Suzuki Roshi used to say, I'm told, when you are you, Zen is Zen. It's letting go of that specialness, that's then you're fully human. And it is gonna have to include the bucket of yuck. It's not like we're going to suddenly become perfect. Other than Mel, I don't know any Zen. I know a bunch of people that I would think of as Zen masters, and I don't know any that are perfect. I told you, do you remember what I, you know what I'm referring to? No. He said, I was lecturing at Berkeley not long ago, I guess. It was last year sometime. And I said that, you know, that I knew a lot of people that I thought of as Zen masters, but none of them was perfect. And the altar was here, and he was on the other side of the altar, right? So I said that, and he leans forward and he says, except for me. So that became a running joke for the rest of the lecture. So let's not forget. There's a picture of him on the wall behind me. I realize that say things like that, that if you're listening to this, you'll think, what is she talking about? Because you don't know that I keep turning around and looking at him and trying to, so I could barely see him, but you can see him over on the, he's on the Tsujiki altar. So it has to include that. But how are you engaging with it? That's You know, are you making it into something special? Are you holding on to it as we do? Because I at least know my bag of shit. And speaking of Sojin, Mel, one of the things that one notices about him and that people say about him was that he was just ordinary. He was so direct. A lot of people thought he was very grandfatherly and sweet, and they talk about him at Tassari. Oh, he's so nice. And those of us who were his serious students would look at each other and say, like, is that the same guy I know? Because he was hard on us. And I like to think that's because he took me seriously. And he knew I wouldn't run away. But at any rate, he was pretty ordinary. You know, he wouldn't go into Zen speak. And he was helpful. I always say this, but I think it's really important to notice that at Kasahara, on days off, you either have breakfast or dinner in the dining room, and it's usually sit down, and there it was not buffet style. It's actually put on the table, and then everybody helps to clean up. And he was the only abbot that I ever noticed that actually helped. He would carry stuff into the kitchen or the dish shack or whatever. And he wouldn't just make one trip. And you got to know him and you saw the depth, but there still was an ordinariness about it. I think he had integrated the practice to such an extent. He said to me once years ago that, or maybe said in lecture, I don't know. Anyway, he said that it seemed like it was so integrated for him that he couldn't tell if he was really practicing or not. Because it just flowed, and he sort of wondered sometimes. And when he was dying, and he knew he was dying, he said to me, well, we'll see now. See now what my practice is worth. I'm still very much grieving, and I forget sometimes, you know, and then I look at this picture behind me when I'm bowing, and I find myself closing my eyes, and it's painful. Oh, right. It hasn't even been a year, so it's not easy for me to talk about that. I wrote all these notes. I don't like them anymore. I feel like, you know, this morning, you know, you sleep on something. And because I read it, and then I read it last night, and then I wrote some notes last night, and then I read it again, and then I slept on it, and this morning I read it again, and it became clearer to me when I thought about that tale for the time being and the superpower. Reb once said, a number of years ago, he said it took him 40 years of practice in order to be willing to be himself. And being Reb is not an easy thing to be. For a lot of reasons, and it isn't all his. The charisma, I think, gets in his way sometimes. He one time said, that was a long time ago, it was when I did a practice period at Green Gulch. I think, I don't know, I used to go on to Sunday, but at any rate, at a smaller group, he taught a class, and it was one night. At the end of the class, he said something like, well, that was a failure, or that didn't go well. And all these people rushed to tell him, no, it was great, no. You know, it's like they couldn't stand his saying something like that. And it was all right, it was fine, but it was not one of his amazing ones. So, whoop-de-doo. You know? And it just interested me how frightened people were about his not being perfect or something like that, and that they needed to reassure him, which meant that he didn't have room to be Reb in that time. And you could also say that was a little manipulative. I don't know why it is, but at any rate, what struck me was how, you know, I remember I was sitting close to him, and I just remember being aware of people rushing to disagree. So I think that he ends, he says, so to be a human being is to be a Buddha, right? That we, in the Parinirvana Sutra, Parinirvana is the time when Buddha entered into final nirvana. And that's when you see those statues of Buddha lying down, that's Buddha dying. People think that's just a statue of Buddha lying down and think, oh, that's wonderful. At any rate, it's a statue of Buddha dying. That he said everything has Buddha nature. Who knows what he said? But at any rate, Dogen says, no, everything is Buddha nature. This is Buddha nature. Is Buddha nature. When there is no Buddha nature, there's nothing at all. Something apart from Buddha nature is just a delusion. It may exist in your mind, but such things actually do not exist. Because there just is. So to be a human being is to be a Buddha. Buddha nature is just another name for human nature. Because rocks have our Buddha nature too, so anyway, quibbling. The most important thing is to express your true nature in the simplest, most adequate way, and to appreciate it in the smallest existence. While you are continuing this practice week after week, year after year, your experience will become deeper and deeper, and your experience will cover everything you do in your everyday life. The most important thing is to forget all gaining ideas, all dualistic ideas. In other words, just practice Zazen in a certain posture. Do not think about anything, just remain on your cushion without expecting anything. Then eventually you will resume your own true nature. That is to say, your own true nature resumes itself. It's a wonderful, wonderful description. And I think that's also true in terms of the superpower, that the attitude of paying attention to your body and your mind integrates into your life more and more, and you notice it more often. Not all the time. You don't always know where your breath is, but more often. And you know, I often say to you that there, you know, in your breath and in your body, there's a huge amount of information. And in your breath and your body are not special. Though we all have our aches and pains, and we all think, they're pretty special. And they are, you know, you have to take care of it. I don't mean to say ignore. So that's how I understand nothing special right now. What do you think? Don't everybody leap up at once. Kelly and then Zach.
I think that, I think the idea of like gaining achieving a superpower and having the superpower be nothing special is a real like unclenching kind of feeling. It's a real, I guess it's liberating, because, you know, I don't know about everyone else's childhood, but mine was bad. but you know, you're told a lot from, you know, family and TV and whatever, like, oh, you're very special and you can, you know, drive forward and achieve great things. And that's it's meant to be very kind, but it's also a great burden.
Mm-hmm.
And just saying, hey, nothing special is such a weight. You get to shed some of that stuff. And that's what I think about.
One thing I think about when in this topic is from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, I'm pretty sure when Suzuki Roshi talking about Zazen says no gaining thoughts, like no gaining mind, right? Is that what
I don't know, he says no gaining.
No gaining mind, and I read that before I ever came here. I read that book. And that for some reason stuck with me. And during COVID, which seems like it's been here forever, but I have noticed that I'm more accepting of things than I used to be. It's like something I've gotten better at. But I don't pat myself on the back. It's just like an observation. And I guess I kind of hope it's in the realm of what he's talking about, that maybe there are fruits of practice that kind of show up. And it's like, that's nice. keep practicing. You haven't really, it's not like you can check that off the list. Because it doesn't happen a lot too, but I notice it more than it used to. And another thing is, and maybe it's because I'm not as busy as I used to be, but I've always been someone in a hurry, and I still am. I came in here sort of blowing around and trying to get things organized and realizing I'm not even a dough on today. But one place I noticed that has changed at least a little is driving, and not like weaving through traffic like I used to. I just kind of pick a lane or I go on my phone and see the fastest way home. And now I do that and I go, I'm gonna go the other way. And it's liberating, I think, to sort of go against your bad habits, I guess. And at least for a moment, not all the time, but and not pat yourself on the back about it, but just to observe it. And so I think I'll stop.
Steve?
I've observed that during this practice period, I decided to purposely prioritize some things that I was going to make sure I kept doing and not quit, as I keep mentioning again and again. But the thing I didn't mention is that practice period is always a time for putting aside something that I don't know if I'm coming back to or not, or that I know I'm coming back to, but I just don't have time for it. And a big thing that has I've put aside is, like I've really told myself, no focusing on writing songs or poems, because I get so obsessed with that that it takes my mind from practice, and I'm not a professional poet or songwriter. There's no reason I have to keep doing that all the time. And I do tend to never get it done. I tend to just write and rewrite and go over and over. And so I said, put that aside. That'll be one burden I don't have. And boy, have I noticed how much ego is involved in that. Like, when I don't do it, I'm sitting there in Zazen going, my songs, my poems, what am I going to do with my stuff? And it's just like almost yelling at me. And I'm just, okay, I hear you. I hear you. I'm getting to see how like not special it is to do that stuff when I'm not doing it. It's actually, I'm not quite to the point where it's liberating, but I'm like, there's some separation now, which I'm not used to. So my stuff.
Yeah, well, it is ridiculous. You know? I mean, and that's what it's useful. You let it, let that tape run, you know, and it is, you know, me.
Yeah.
How could you say that to me? Or it's mine. Because it isn't about songs. It's just wanting. And there's a wanting. There's a longing. You know, I don't know, Freud, Jung, all of the above, anyway, they say that, you know, we have a longing to return to the womb. And I say to you, there's a longing deeper than that. And that's pretty, but there is that. The Buddha talks about it some. But there's just this, there's just longing. And sometimes when it comes up like that, you get a little view of it, you know, so. Don't stop writing songs.
Yeah.
But you know, when they can come as your expression of your nature. So anyway, that thank you is a great example.
Yeah.
Kate or Dana, do you want to say anything, either of you? Kate?
Sure. Thank you. And thank you for talking about Mel. I love hearing stories about him. As you said, when I first came, I mean, I kind of thought, well, I'll come here and I'll sit and I'll learn the forms and then I'll get enlightened and then I'll be a bodhisattva, and bodhisattvas don't suffer, right? So that was my misunderstanding. I didn't get the whole suffer with people. So, you know, it pretty quickly became apparent that that wasn't the point. But it didn't keep me from wanting to feel differently than I felt when I sat down on the cushion. And that's what was hard at the beginning, was to accept what I was when I sat down on that cushion, and still sometimes is, but I can say, like both Zach and well, everybody has said that it's the word that came to my mind was relief. It's kind of a relief to lay your burden down, you know, to go, okay, I'm just like everybody else, you know, I'm just, you know, which was not anything I ever wanted to be, you know. Growing up, you were supposed to try to be special, try to be better, try to be smarter, faster, more talented, all of those things. And as you, over time, you know, what happened very quietly, like you said, is that I started to have moments throughout my day where I noticed I wasn't so reactive, or I noticed the pleasure I could take in slicing a red pepper while I was preparing dinner, or, you know, any one of the hundreds of the smell of laundry when you take it out of the dryer, or all of those things. And what is becoming more and more clear to me is that that's it. that's part of it anyway. I mean, it's also, it's identifying with the simple pleasures, and also for me, it's not running away from the painful things either. You know, sitting there while I cry, or when I have a deep pain in my heart, which is part of my lived experience, to go ahead and sit with that too. And but I'm glad it wasn't what I thought it was. This is much better than I could have imagined, I think. Thank you. That's it.
These are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless.